According to Socrates, virtue is knowledge, and the person necessarily acts upon the knowledge that they have. Do you believe it?
No.
No. Well, why should such a brilliant intelligence as Socrates make that remark? Could he have been deceived? Or is it that he had a very special point of view? Supposing you had absolute knowledge, you knew everything that is to be known, could you then disobey it? It's a very important point, this, you know. It's a good old argument of the Dominicans and the Franciscans. Do you have to obey truth, you know? Can we have a show of hands on it? Who believes that if you know a truth, you necessarily obey it? No hands. Who believes that when you do know a truth, that sometimes you don't obey it? All hands up, very good. That's a device, actually, for getting you to improve your circulation by doing arm exercises. Now, let's examine this very carefully, because it shall be the centre, not only of tonight's discussion, but the rest of our work, as long as we live, to discover why we do not act upon knowledge that we possess. Let's take an example. All human beings derive from one primordial human type. We know this because all human beings have the same number of chromosomes in their sexual cells, and this can only be by the simple process of division of a primordial cell. So actually, there is one human being pluralized by self-division. If that is so, why is this human race so thoroughly disliking of itself? Why doesn't the human race as such embody universal love? Why not? Trevor says it does, and Gerhard says because it can't get its own way. Something to do with free will. Do I have to do a drawing of it on this horrible machine? I hope that the pencils won't work. If they don't, I can switch off. I'll just test it in the corner. Well, the damn thing is working. There's the mark I made, see? Now, from the fact of genetics, we all have the same number of chromosomes, whether we're black, white, or Yiddish. And we know, therefore, by the law of genetic projection, that we must have derived from the same primordial mutant egg. So, let's draw one. That is a primordial egg. And its method of multiplication is quite simply division. So, when it divides, it separates out and it becomes two eggs. And when it wants further to divide, it does it again. Two eggs. We have a very simple rule that the essential qualities of the original egg, when the egg divides, become the essential qualities of the divided cells. That means that whatever the quality was of this original cell is perpetuated in the derivative cells, which are simply the original cell self-divided. Now, we want to know how did that cell come into existence. Let's say that the forces of cosmos produced that cell, because modern astronomy even confesses that. Perhaps even Patrick Moore, in the middle of a nightmare, might confess that terrestrial beings have evolved within a solar system that once did not have planetic condensations. And the solar system was once part of a universal power which had not yet condensed into a solar system, but was part of an infinite field of power. And only by self-subdivision did it make itself. So we have to say a peculiar thing, that this self-division is an inherent tendency of the original infinite power. Does that sound logical? Are there any dissenters? If so, let them leave the room immediately and never return. Are there any dissenters? Tendency. By tendency, I mean that the observed fact throughout the universe is that there is a movement towards some objective. You know those experts with the feather duster who go around the house periodically moving the dust around. No sooner do they flick it in the air, it starts coming back again. You call it gravity, don't you? Tendencies to accumulate on centers are everywhere. If you get tired, your body tends to sink back to the earth. Now, tending means, funny word, the word means stretch and move towards. Let's draw a stretch. Here is a stretch. The word for that stretch is tan, and the law, tantra, the law of stretching. Another word for it, Sanskrit word, spanda. When you stretch your hand, you span. Imagine the original power of the universe. If it contracts onto a center, like that, and makes a little point, there, in the act of doing so, it has disturbed its original equilibrium, an equilibrium called in yoga pralaya. Perfect balance. To the physicist, maximum entropy. The equable distribution of energy throughout infinity. If that energy initiates a movement to contract, it has strained the surrounding. So that if that movement towards this point comes from infinity, the point there is being squeezed, and this part is put under strain. So we can draw the same point and put it in the middle of the strain. The fact of energy condensing onto points precipitates the point by contraction, contraction. And in the very moment of the contraction occurring, there is an expansion opposite motion. Now this is logically unavoidable. If you contract, you have moved the energy round the center of contraction, and you have produced a strain. And unless you keep concentrating on that point, you will expand again, and the point will disappear. Now let's call that point, shall we use a Hebrew letter for it? Are there any complaining Jewish members who don't want to use a Jewish letter for that point? How about you, Michael? No objection, right? I'll write it in English for the sake of the goys. Yeah? That's a yod. I'll draw it in the Hebrew. It is simply a little dot, like that. It is called a jot. A dot. And if we change the D to T and the Y to J, which is quite legitimate, you will discover that a true examination of the English language will show that jot is simply an English mispronunciation for Hebrew yod. How do you like that idea? That the English don't know how to pronounce Hebrew letters, so that when they see a yod, they say jot.
I think you're making a point.
That was a Hebrew contribution, of course. Now, the important thing is this. Y-O-D and J-O-T mean the affirmation of a division, the affirmation of a crucifixion. if you take the energy of the universe and contract it and pose it a point, you have actually, locally, in the zone of the point, in making the point, fixated the energy by the condensation. Instead of being a free energy, it is now tied to the point. And what we call egotism in human beings is nothing but the logical implication of positing power on a point. Our physical organism is a point of contraction of solar energies. Every time we posit the egoic structure, the individuated point of our being, we produce a strain in the social environment and a strain in solar energy, a strain in cosmic energy. So that to be egotistic is really energy expending to a remarkable degree. To assert your individual egotistic existence is very, very hard work. Can you photograph that in your mind a moment while I remove this offending noise and light? The original primordial mutant which became the human race had a certain number of chromosomes in it, and by subdivision of that egg, the human race, as we know it, has arisen. But the original quality, the attribute, the characteristic tendency or inclination to behave in a certain way of cosmic energy was posited in that first egg. And when the egg subdivided, the same tendency, the same power, the same inclination towards positing points occurred in every derivative of that egg. So that the egotism in each individual human being, the tendency to keep focusing on myself as an individual, is really the product of a cosmic self-precipitation. So the egotism of all human beings, and for that matter, all living beings, and mineral beings, to cohere, of a rock to cohere with itself, fall on its center, is the same cosmic tendency or inclination, the movement towards a certain kind of activity. And this same tendency produces a strain. Now, supposing we say that the precipitation of the point requires, because it takes energy to posit it, counter energy to take it to pieces. And if we call coming to exist as an individual life, then logically life presupposes death. In positing ourselves as individuals, we have expended a large amount of energy over millions of years. We have done so because cosmic energy tends to do this, and the fact of gathering the energy together is inducing a strain in the cosmic field of energy. And this strain demands our return into the universal non-contracted energy. And this demand that we return is what we call the will to death, the will to extinction. Now, if we see these two movements as logically presupposing each other, we can see that death is as good as life. When you come into existence as an egoic being, an individuated jot or dot of power, you have strained universal energy. You have disturbed the equilibrium of universal power, the pralaya, the equalized state, and you have posited within it lots and lots and lots of little points. The glyph for the infinite before creation, before encapsulation, is the Hebrew letter Aleph, or the Greek Alpha, the English letter A, pronounced R. And in that same letter there are three parts, and there are three letters to pronounce that letter, A, L, P. The P is aspirated and becomes F. Aleph, Aleph. Now, the first part of that word means the absolute, and the middle part of that word means to conjoin, to stimulate, to goad. And the last part means a mouth speaking. So that the word Aleph means the absolute, self-stimulating to enunciate its own nature. And that is before the letter B. And the letter B is the letter that means encapsulation, circumscription. This primordial tendency in the infinite, when expanded to contract, and when contracted to expand, is in every creature, living, human, animal, vegetable, and so-called inorganic mineral. The tendency to contract under cold, to expand under heat. Now, this opposite tendency in everything, no exceptions, is the cause of what we call vibration. The universe is a vibrational energy because it alternates between compressing, producing points, which are individuals, and then stretching these points out of existence. If I get a sheet of rubber and pinch a bit, and then get hold of the edges and pull it out, so the bit I pinched has now been stretched, and then repeat this, pinch, stretch, pinch, stretch. That is exactly what happens in universal energy. On the pinch point, it's egotistic. On the stretch point, it is non-existent. To exist means to stand out. And when that point isn't there, there is no thing to stand out against the background of no thingness. No thingness does not mean absolute voidity. It means power stretched in an equable way. Now, the problem in all religions, without exception, is how to get rid of a sense of unease in the human race. How to get rid of a feeling of alienation. The egotistically stressed individual feels at the very moment of stressing that he has alienated himself from the surrounding. You can't assert your own individual egoic being without being aware that you have separated yourself somewhat from your companions. You sit, each one of you, inside your skin, and if somebody dares to touch your skin without your permission, you feel invaded. On the other hand, if nobody dares to touch your skin, you feel isolated. Isolated, isola. Insular, a little island, nobody taking any notice. Imagine a very charming girl sitting on the far side of a dance hall on her own, and nobody is going to say something to her. There's something the matter with her expression. How does she feel? She's got a wall card, isn't she? How does she feel if nobody comes up and says, "May I?" or gives her an ice cream or tickles her under the chin? She's there, wrapped in her own skin. She's insulated, isolated by her own self-precipitation. Nothing precipitated her except the energy in the place where she is. There's not something other than this universal energy. To use an Islamic phrase, there is no God but God. The first part of that phrase actually says, there is nothing, and then the last part, but God. We can translate it very simply, only God. That means infinite power, infinite intelligence, infinite presence. Only that power really is. Whatever else it is, of apparent isolation, is isolated by permission of that power. Elseness is a deliberate stress to produce an existent being inside an infinite ocean of power. Just as the ocean makes little wavelets on it like this, And each little wavelet may think I'm a little wavelet and stretch up a bit and get slightly taller than the next wavelet. But it does so only because it is a part of the cosmic ocean. And it has no power, severed from the ocean, if severance were possible, to lift itself. That it's the whole body of that water that is undulating and lifting up these crests and dropping them in the troughs. Now, if this is thoroughly understood, universal energy is the sole cause of every phenomenon in the universe. Everything that we know about is nothing but infinite energy which has built cosmos and is now, at this very moment, maintaining it. Now, all religions agree in this basic fact that all manifest beings are creatures. Creatures is from a base, kra, to create, to encapsulate, to enclose. Each individual is enclosed by that infinite energy and is itself a local modality of that energy. A little modification, a little waving of the energy locally, and you have something. All the religions and all the philosophies talk incessantly about this fundamentally simple thing. And the ethic arising from it is quite simple. That infinite field of power, which is sentient, feeling itself, is all there is. And therefore anything done anywhere by any of its modalities is carried throughout the whole continuum. The continuum has no parts, so it is actually impossible for any individual being to act in such a manner that he has no effect whatever on his environment. To act is to influence the infinite. And the infinite has precipitated beings in order that they may so act. So the ethic is quite simply, inasmuch as you do it to the least of these, you do it to me, says that power continuum. There is only that power. So what is the meaning of the expression, I have loved Jacob and hated Esau? Is there room for hate? If the continuum sentient power is the only power, well, that depends how you translate the word hate. Now, the actual meaning of the word, the H and the T, means hierarchical crucifixion. Hate. Why did he say, I have loved Jacob and hated Esau? Because Jacob was an agriculturalist who knew how to make bean soup, and Esau roamed about the place not knowing whether he was going to get anything to eat today. And the power that created the universe says, I work with those who work with me. But those who do not work according to my continuum information and who egotistically strive against it, those I pin on the fact of hierarchy. We have a simple thing, you make a walled city, and then you make the city bigger and bigger and bigger, till finally there is no room outside the city wall for the nomadic person to wander about. You've seen that in the last few years in this country and in Europe, that the gypsies have less and less place to wander, less and less place to camp, fewer situations. Always expanding cities are taking up the empty, spare ground until there will be no room for a gypsy, unless the gypsies fight back. It's dead in law. We see this movement in two opposite directions, and this is what we mean by dialectic. You are required by that infinite power to cooperate with cooperative beings. You are required to pin a being who refuses cooperation, and pinning is called hate. But you don't have to go in a fizz with yourself to hate. You don't have to tear yourself to pieces. All you have to do is interpret that word that if there's a lot of destructive activity going on and you yourself are on the side of cooperation, that you operate to the best of your ability to increase cooperation and not to fall into joining the Vandals by going to wherever they live and breaking up their homes. There was a Greek philosopher who taught that the universe was operated by love and hate, and all he was talking about was forces of coherence, love, and forces of disintegration, hate. So hate and love need not be the sentimental, unbalanced emotional states that people generally tend to think now. Love can be an intelligent, working, cooperative activity, and hate can be quite simply that you keep rebuilding the world that other people are trying to take to pieces. If you find a destructive person and you react to that destructive person by a destructive counteractivity, you've actually gone away from the love, the coherent side, and you've joined his camp of destroyers. And mutual destruction is very bad philosophy, very bad religion, very bad logic, because it means that every man will tear every man to pieces. We are going to talk about techniques of bringing ourselves into the condition of understanding what Socrates meant when he said, if you have knowledge, you necessarily act upon it. Supposing a man feels like committing suicide and he goes to the edge of a cliff, and he's seen people before falling off cliffs and dying, so he says, my purpose is to die, and he jumps off. He jumps off hoping that the laws of nature won't change, or that one of those funny female typhoons that rip along the Pacific coast won't come at the very moment he jumps and blow him up instead of down, and swirl him around a bit and then drop him in a tub of water. That can happen. He hopes that the law will stay as it is. So when he says, I will commit suicide because I don't want to live and I will jump off this cliff, he's relying on a law of nature which has held within his experience. But supposing he is informed that he does not yet know everything about the law, and that the law of the universe is actually a law of the balancing of opposite parts, and then he adds this into his computation. Now, if he does this, what is the meaning of committing suicide? Because he can't get rid of himself, because he is a modality of the infinite energy. Killing oneself simply means that trying to ruin a little individuated organism which over millions of years has been involved from universal forces. To commit suicide, that is quite simply merely to act against the intention of cosmic law to make an individual human being by smashing that organism. When you smash the organism, have you done anything other than return that little packet of energy to the field of cosmic power from which it derived? No, you have not. Now, if you get this extra bit of knowledge that you cannot kill yourself, you cannot destroy yourself, what happens to your intention to commit suicide? You have to reconsider it. Now, in that sense, Socrates would say, you see, with further knowledge, you are further restricted in your activities. Every new knowledge restricts our activities in new ways. So let's make a big leap and say, okay, supposing we know everything, aren't we going to be infinitely restricted? And the answer is yes, we are. We're going to be restricted absolutely. To what? To the original power which created the universe. Are we not going to be restricted finally to accepting the essential nature and characteristics, the essence and the attributes of that infinite power which has made the universe? And if we accept that infinite power, which is the meaning of Islam, acceptance of that infinite power, if we accept it, are we not going to accept the dialectic which is in it, that when we posit ourselves as existent beings, we have strained the environment, and if we try to take out the positing and put it back into the universe, we will arrive at a state of rest, pranaya, from which we started, which will immediately reposit us again. And are we going to posit ourselves, or stretch out to unposit ourselves, or are we going to feel sensitively the intention of the absolute power to posit us, and then say, okay, absolute power, I salute you. You have posited me and made me think about you. That's clever. But you are the source of my being, my feeling, my thought, my will. In a real sense, I have not thought, I have not felt, I have not willed, O absolute. You have, in the place of my being. Now when you see this, what can you say? God, the absolute, has led me to this insight that actually that infinite power, which is God, has put me where I am, has put each one of us where we are for its own peculiar reasons, in order to produce a universe of interplaying forces of infinite variety, and to accept this. Now if we accept this thoroughly, we can accept everything that happens to us, whatever it is, which an egotistic person would call good or bad, and say it is neither good nor bad, except in the terms of the absolute, not in the terms of the egotistic individual. Get rid of the egotistic individual terms of reference and say what has happened to me to date has happened by the will of the absolute. And I myself have been willed by this absolute to will. That the human will is part of the will of the absolute to humanize a being. What does it feel like if we actually believe this? To say, the absolute power has posited my friend Robin Boothroy, Trevor Smith, my archenemy Gerhardt, and so on, and that it has done this out of a colossal cosmic sense of humor. And I accept the joke. And I accept that I cannot not accept. And then am the necessity. Like Spinoza says about God, God acts of necessity. Because being an infinite, intelligent, creative power, whatever it does, even if you will to do nothing, is nothing but that infinite, intelligent power there operating in that way. No complaints, no formal means of redress, nothing but submission to the absolute. But the absolute has will that human beings will. It is not saying I am willing and you are nothing. It is saying I am willing and I will you to will, and I will you to will as I will. Like Christ says, it is my will to do the will of him who sent me. And like Muhammad would say, we have nothing to do except obey the will of God. Whether you say Al or Allah, it's the same word etymologically anyway. It means that the absolute is working. In view of this, our work can only be a daily, hourly, minutely repositing of our being into the absolute. We're in it anyway, so we accept it. In which case, when you use your eyes, you say, up to date, my eyes have felt like my eyes, and I have forgotten God. I wrote a little thing out of the Quran a few weeks ago. When I remember God, God remembers me. And if I forget God, God still remembers me. The absolute doesn't forget its own modalities, although the modalities may be so wrapped in themselves and their own little functions that they forget the infinite ocean of power. How often do we in our business from day to day think, good God, we're in a solar system, in a sidereal system, in an infinite vast stretch of power. I wonder what the power wants me to do today about that return form. If you ask yourself every moment, every split second, moment means a turning point of decision. Every time you have to make a decision, you ask yourself, how does the Absolute view this? As intelligent, dialectical power operating simultaneously in two directions. One towards myself as individual, and one towards myself as non-individual. I'm nothing as a non-individual, but the nothing which I am as a non-individual is nothing other than this infinite God, which has posited me as an individual to consider itself as a positor of individuals, and then said, now don't forget me, don't forget infinity, don't identify with your finitude to the point where you actually say, oh, there is no God, there is no Absolute, I'm on my own, I'm one against millions, and they're all a rotten lot anyway, unlike myself, pure of intention, although I make mistakes, of course, a few. Nevertheless, my intention is right. Sometimes, I think, when I think about it, this is called the human condition. We all know things that we don't want to know. Why is this? This is the question that we've been offered tonight. Why do we not act upon the knowledge we have? Because we definitely have it. We know we're all human beings. We know we've all got the same number of chromosomes. We know we could all practice brotherly love like Freemasons theoretically do, or all followers of the new Polish Pope do, or all followers of that other funny fellow in Belfast who is doubtful about the Pope's intention. We know that all these things go on. Why do we persist? Now, egotism says, because I want to. Like Gerhardt said, but to accept otherwise would be not to get my own way. But that is not the reason. The reason is because the Absolute Power is very interested in observing the pattern of your errors. Can you believe that? That every egotistical individual act is willed by the Absolute through that individual. For what? Because by means of the collectivity of those errors, the consciousness of the individuals precipitated by that same infinite power is sharpened and gradually led more and more and more into the condition that finally results in what we call reflexive self-consciousness, dedicated not to egotism, but to the furtherance of that absolute cosmic purpose. Now, what are we to do about it in terms? Unless we recognize that our errors are not our errors, it's egotism to think they're our errors, we haven't got enough intelligence to hold ourselves together to make an error properly. We can't even trip over a carpet deliberately without making a show of it, can we? How many human beings do you know that can fall downstairs without doing a theatrical performance in the middle of it in case anyone is watching? It's very, very difficult. The will of the Absolute is that by the clash of the erroneous behaviours of people, there shall arise in those very same individuals, in their infinite numbers, there shall arise an awareness that they are not their own, that they're being worked upon to force them to become aware that at the very moment the Absolute posits the individual is being forced to remember the Absolute. And the only thing that makes the individual remember the Absolute is the error. Man's extremity is God's opportunity. If men were capable, egoically, of designing a purpose for themselves egoically, and fulfilling it egoically, and enjoying it egoically, they could not remember their infinite source. Is it possible to conceive that a fully successful egotistic individual who can go through life getting his own way all the time, could he remember the infinite power from which he derived? Would he not be carried away by success into thinking maybe there isn't anybody at all except myself and the rest not so smart. Therefore, what happens to our error and our guilt, our sense of shame, our fear of punishment, if we know that everything we have done that has been what we call egotistically wrong, erroneous, foolish, stupid, was willed for us by that abstinent? How do you feel? Can you feel egotistically proud of your guilt? Have you seen any person saying, "I'm guilty and I know I am, but I'm in the right as well on this occasion"? They do, don't they? They say it. I've heard them say it many times. And better a strong wrong than a weak right. Everything that is performed by human beings is performed as wavelets on a cosmic ocean of intelligent power by permission of that power. Now, if God gives you permission and the energy to act in a certain way, which when it becomes painful you call error, has not He, by His permission and the energy supply, participated with you in your error? Isn't that so? What can we do about it? We can say, "Lord, how much smaller number of errors today I think I'm learning." You can actually learn to say your prayers that way, you know. You know, saying prayers really means reminding yourself that your next mistake is permitted and energized by God. And you say, "God, I honestly think I have learned enough today. Sufficient for the day is the evil thereof. Can I be let up a little? Can you just allow me not to make mistakes tomorrow?" And a voice comes from heaven, "Thou lazy swine." If you listen, you'll hear it. It's only when you're tired that you feel like that. But you know, the tiredness is sent by God too. Because if you didn't have it, you'd wear yourself out very quickly. And if you were egotistically successful, you wouldn't last 5 minutes. You'd be like Sinatra, climbing up the mic hand over fist to make himself vertical again after a rejuvenation treatment of hormones of unborn calves. You see, there's evidence all over the world, in every city, in every town, in every country, that human beings, egotistically identified, think they're doing their own thing. Like St. Paul's choir singing, "I did it my way." But the "my way" is simply the way God lets them go. First He says, "I will give you will." That's called the inbreathing of spirit. And then "I will put a ring round you and say, and I will give you what is called egotism, and you will then see how you go on with it. And until you cry out for mercy so damn hard that I can't not listen to you, you're not going to get it." You see, you have to do what in mystical poems in the East is called loving God so much you can't even remember your girlfriend's name. Do you believe it? Can you love God so powerfully that you can't remember your favorite girl's name? Now that is the precondition of divine salvation. Now there's an Islamic trick about that one. The thing is, say, you know, God has a lot of names. One of the great sheikhs, a mystic, said, "All the names of God are names of God, but they're all different names of one essence. And because they are of one essence, really, all those names are one name. So select from that multitude of names one name which you like and worship God under that name. And that is the worship of all names, because all names are the names of one essence. So why not choose your girlfriend's name and worship her as God? Not goddess. Just God. Never mind the sex talk implicit in the termination S. sound of the serpent. And the same for women, that they can actually think their husband is gone. That's a dreadful shock. Can you imagine him in the morning getting up? Have you ever seen a bog-eyed god? The answer is yes. In the Norse language, bog means gone. Bog-eyed means having a design to look like Louis Jouvet in Amphitryon 38 with sparkling eyes. Make your eyes sparkle like the divinity. See the sparkle in your lover's eyes and say, never mind the infinite God, that is an abstraction. Here is a precipitated incarnate God in this being, and then operate. I am here, God, in loving service to you, God. And if I worship this one name efficiently, I have worshipped all the names of God in this one act. It's a dialectical trick. Don't you think it's good? Oh, it really works, you know. If you do that to somebody, it's absolutely unbearable. It divinizes them. It actually brings the God function up in them. And they feel their little egotism goes, ooh, is it worth it? I'm now absolutely responsible. This card has worked a trick on me. He's requiring divine responses. The only thing for me to do in self-defense is say, I don't understand you. I'm not good at metaphysics. I don't understand ontology. I can't understand theological principles. So will you please treat me like Maggie, like you used to, without this infinite divinization of my being? And if you're on center, you say, no, I will not. To me, you are God. And you say, Maggie. It's an equation, God equals Maggie. Thatcher. And you look with profound, infinite, no good finite, infinite devotion. And whatever you say, now, however much you splutter and cough and deliver your asthmatic responses, you are God. I know it, and you know it on the inside. And I'm not going to let up on you until you correspond with it. Scream, that's God screaming. Cry, have hysteria. Fall on the floor, tear the carpet, rub your mascara over your cheeks. It's all God doing it. But I know it is, and so do you. And I'm not letting go. Now, if you do this, you've solved all life's problems with one little trick. Now, our starting question was, why do we not act upon knowledge that we have? And the answer is because God, who is this infinite power, has no intention of letting us get away with it so easily. Because the only reason we don't want to make mistakes is because they are painful and they're educational. And we want to be egotistically finite and limited because we want pleasures, and we want a limited world with limited responsibilities. And God says, no. There is no limited world, there is only infinite power. What can we do about it? Now, at any given moment, we are a number of people here. Some of us may be dissenting. There's a flaw in this. A man actually said to me today, well, of course, one can nod one's assent to these propositions, but if one assents to it, and he meant, are we not responsible? Absolutely. Well, the answer is yes, of course. And if we accept all these propositions of the infinite continuum of sentient power, do you know what we all are? We are all, believe it or not, married to each other in the full sense of this word married. Where married means that our substantial original protoplasmic egg has differentiated itself into millions of eggs and divided it into categories of being, and is holding them in that differentiated state. It will not let them lapse into unawareness of the differences that the infinite cosmic power has created to make a world that fundamentally is joyful. The differences are affirmed for the fascinating interplay of differentiating forces. It would be quite ridiculous to say we are all human beings. Today, with language translation techniques, we can put on a pair of earphones in a meeting and have an immediate translation, so we can all understand each other. Therefore, we should all will the same things, and we would call that an agreement. But the absolute power of the universe, which is called God by religionists, that power says, no, I do not want that sameness. I want the sameness as a fundamental substance for the infinity of differential behavior patterns. The sameness will keep us together. The differentiations will make sure that it's worthwhile being kept together. Again, the dialectic. We are all fundamentally human protoplasm. We all move towards the present, away from the painful. We do this with different speeds according to our temperament, but we all do it. But we are all unique, and we are unique from before the beginning of creation. Now let's think about that. We'll put this horrible machine on again for a moment. I'll wind those out of the way. I will use another letter. I will draw it like this. Now there is a letter. It's the letter A in the Hebrew, the Aleph. I want you to see that it's made of three parts. And this part means form. And this part means power. And this part means feeling. And this is the letter that signifies that same infinite power which eternally exists and permeates all creation, but is in no sense restrained by that creation. And then I want you to think. The same letter is covered with little dots like this. And each little dot is one of those letters, the tenth letter, Yod. It is full of individuals, but that is before the generation of the letter B, the Beit, which means encapsulation. Fixate that in your mind, please. That Aleph signifies, like the Greek Alpha, before creation, an infinite power which has form, power, and feeling evaluation of the relation between form and power. Form individuates, power drives, and feeling evaluates. And that this triplicity is before creation. And that all the little dots produced within that infinite spirit, that Alpha Aleph, all those little dots are entirely unique. Because there is no overriding control over the infinite. The will of the infinite is to individuate, to produce uniquenesses. Long before these uniquenesses are encapsulated, they are in the infinite. And this has very peculiar implications. It means that every one of us, before we came to birth, before we came in a physical body on earth, before we came into the range of the solar system, before we became in the star system, we are eternally in that infinite power as already unique beings. We are unique. We are not the same before we start. And we are pulled together and precipitated downwards into human protoplasm, and the only similar factor is the protoplasm. In each piece of protoplasm, each seed in a plant, there is a unique proposition. If you propagate potatoes by cutting them into bits, where there are eyes, and you plant them in that way, vegetative propagation, you get the same kind of potato every time. But if you get seed potatoes and propagate the seeds, they are slightly different. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. Usually most of them are worse than the best. But the seed is unique. And that uniqueness belongs in eternity, belongs before the universe is precipitated and encapsulated. So in a very peculiar way, in the infinite, before creation begins, we all are. We are there. The way of translating the name of God given by God to Moses, I am that I am, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, means I am what I am, I was what I was, I shall be what I shall be. It transcends the three times, past, present, and future. Uniquely. Uniqueness of the human soul is an eternal fact before the universe is made. The victory is won before the foundation of the world. We are uniquely spirits, and spiritually unique before we come into bodies. So what is the purpose of putting us into bodies? The answer is quite simple. In our infinite uniqueness before creation, because we are unique, does it not follow that we're absolutely isolated from each other? Is not every individual who is unique necessarily isolated from every other unique being as a unique form?
You can't say that, because if we accept about the idea of continuing,
yes,
having no part, how can it not
the self,
in that
continuum,
the parts feel itself
as present. But don't they feel each other's uniqueness is a formal determinant of difference?
But you said, well, that's the same thing,
doesn't that imply an essential non-difference? No, of course it doesn't. If it is your uniqueness that you're focusing on, that is what you feel. If you felt for your sameness, you would lose immediately your formal reference of difference. Yeah? Are we agreed? If there is uniqueness, and spirit means formal power, if you focus on the power and see a triangle, a square, a circle, a crescent, in the very act of seeing the triangularity of a triangle, the squareness of a square is eliminated by the triangularity of the triangle, is it not? Formally.
Then why did the angels refuse to come down if that's the case, if they were isolated? Why the hell did they change their minds?
Simple. Each one was singing his own merry song of praise to his own uniqueness.
Yes, but he felt isolated in that unique.
Yes, but he loves the sound of his own voice. Have you ever watched Sunday night? Have you ever watched Sunday night in the churches? With people singing, suddenly comes that the camera might be on them. I had a very interesting experience a few years ago when a woman of the Congregational Church came to me and said, I have a serious ethical problem and they're going to televise our church. And unfortunately one of our lady members has a squint. Is it ethical to put her behind a pillar? You see, there wasn't that a desire to keep the uniqueness of that church, give a good show on the telly. Squint is not allowed here. The fact is that in the uniqueness, focus on the uniqueness for a moment, please. You've all got shapes of noses of your own, haven't you, and ears, and bust shapes and belly shapes and thigh shapes and knee shapes. Have you got any shapes, Hanukkah? Yes, you have. I know you don't like very short mini types.
Pardon? The lady who was behind the pillar, she was
pillar society. She could be, yeah. Because you could hide another, even more cross-eyed one behind her. Yeah. Now, I wanted to focus, but there are three factors: form, that shape, the Greek word idea, the idea, the form, Latin, the shape, Anglo-Saxon, right? Idea, form, shape. Unique, utterly unlike any other form or shape. And yet, in one respect, identical. What? Every form, every shape has a contour that binds it. But when you think about your uniqueness, are you not necessarily differentiating yourself from every other being? As to your uniqueness, are you or are you not? Pardon? Yes, dear. Dividing by ego, you use the word correctly, phonetically. It means one whose life is grossly encapsulated. If you transcend your grossness, you will discover a uniqueness not based on gross material egotism. The uniqueness is a uniqueness of spiritual power. Power which is formulating itself uniquely on purpose. Long before there is a gross planetary world, there is spiritual intelligence vibrating in unique patterns and making every individual into a unique being of intelligence threefold. The form is different, the feeling of the form is necessarily different, and the will working through that felt different form is different. So there's a triple uniqueness in every being before the creation of the world. And insofar as they affirm their uniquenesses, they all sing in their own ways. You know the meaning of cacophony, don't you?
Eugene, in order to understand this, can you comparatively say that in the ocean can therefore feel its own drops of uniqueness?
Oh, yes. Yes, you know Arnold in his Light of Asia thing has a statement, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, meaning the self, the Buddhistic self, is obliterated.
And each drop in the ocean knows itself with its own dropness.
Yes, when you slip into the shining sea, you've still got your own dropness.
But it's still part of the ocean.
Well, is it?
Well,
what does part mean? You see, the word part...
Part and
non-part, that's a good bit of dialectical Zen. It's a part and non-part, because it's not set apart with a gap of absolute voidity between itself and the next part.
It only knows itself for, as itself in that
state. Yes. Is this part of the ocean, this wave, a part of this wave?
Yes.
And no.
And no, yes.
You see? Yes, because it's trough run into the trough of the other one. No, because his crest is not that crest. Now we are all absolutely unique before the world is created. And we are all, because remember what we said, these points, these yods, are precipitated like that by contraction of power, and then relaxed, and then struck, and then relaxed. Now if we alternate an energy behavior in this way, we contract, we expand, we contract, we expand, that is called an alternation of compression, decompression, compression, decompression. And that is exactly the definition of a sound wave. A sound wave is an alternation of compression, decompression. So each unique being is uttering sounds. And every time it goes like this, and lets go, it uniquely posits itself, lets go uniquely, and uniquely posits itself again. But this time it isn't the same one that it posited a moment ago. It is a new self, like Heraclitus said. It is not the same neck that is washed by the same man every day. Well, first of all, let's have a look. Do we all remember the hexonic field drawing? Please say yes. It's a lot of circles. You get your compasses, you draw a circle, you shift these. Point to the compass, to the periphery, you draw another circle, and you keep doing the same thing till the whole paper is covered in circles. Each circle has a centre, and the centre of any given circle is surrounded by the spiritual lines of other centers. We are unique in that we vibrate characteristically differently from the next circle. We are identical in that we are circles. We use the word hexon for this because it produces a six-fold division when you walk around your periphery of the circle with your compasses. And those six become five senses and common sense, which links the five. That uniqueness means that every individual is making a sound which is its own peculiar sound in eternity, before time commences. These songs, pong, 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 pong. Sheila, sing me an F. No? Can you sing me an F? Trevor, will you do the same note an octave below? Now, is it not true that there is a characteristic difference? So we can actually tell that that particular sound came from Sheila and the other sound came from Trevor. Yeah? Did you see Lord Joconda last night? No, good for you. There could have been an alternative if ITV had not been on strike. We have to be kind to our web-footed friends, don't we? Every being before creation is making a sound, and the sound is unique every second, every moment. You go, Pete, sing me another actually, now listen carefully. Was that the same as the other F? No, it wasn't, was it? It wasn't. You could hear her gathering herself together in a new way. You felt that, didn't you? Yeah. And there was a certain characteristic vibrato came in the second version that was not in the first version. Yeah? And will you do me another one? The same F, please. I'm asking you deliberately to make the same sound again. Was that the same? Was the attack the same? Right, now imagine an infinity of beings. Can we all do this together, please? You all remember that note, more or less. I don't care whether you sing it an octave higher, if you're queer, or an octave lower, you see. And will you try to make that same noise together? Count down. I'll count 3, 2, 1, 0. Do you remember that note? I don't care if you don't. But do your best, right? We're all going to do it. 3, 2, simultaneously. 1, 0, go. How do you like that? Do you think it is good? Don't you think it is good? I mean, considering we're not in the choral society. But we could be, couldn't we? With a bit of practice. That was without practice. Hmm? Yes, and if you were listening, you know, you began to get something of what is meant by divine joy at hearing an infinity of these damn points crying away there. Oh Lord, we praise thee. Let's try that one. Started interrelating. It did, didn't it? Now let's have somebody, a leader of the canting. Donald will do, he's got a nice voice. Donald, will you say, O Lord, we praise thee? I want you to sing it for me. Just, O Lord, we praise thee, about that pace. But I want you to think about the absolute meaning of the Lord. Because I know your name is Donald Lord. But think about the absolute. Yes, O Lord, we praise thee. Any tune? An Anglican church, that. will you repeat that for us, Donald? I want you to listen very, very carefully, because I'm going to ask you to the best of your ability reproduce it.
Yes, I like that.
It's difficult not to be unique. If the grace notes kill you, leave them out. Because he won't let you. The Lord is what we call immediate. If you try to do it twice, he'll stop you the minute he's done it. I heard that the first time. Unlike human beings, I listen. No, I'm very graceful. I thought it was rather orthodox from Methodist. Right? The next version, yes? Yeah. Listen very carefully, because I want you to remember it and reproduce it so that you know what God puts up with in the next verse. yes, quite all right.
Yeah. Oh!
What? Okay, I have two voices. Will you please join him, Anthony? You want two voices, you take the other one, please. Yeah? Together? Count down. 3, 2, 1, 0.
Oh, Lord, we praise thee, praise.
Right. Very good. Now, I want you to remember that. To the best of your ability, at least you can remember the form observe of the words. O Lord, we praise thee. Now, feel the feeling that Donald and Anthony had, and then sing in any way that you can approximate to that. Don't worry, you won't reach it. In any way that you can approximate to it, O Lord, we praise thee, at approximately that tempo. Are you ready? All together. And listen, because God hears it, right? 3, 2, 1. 0. You know, if you didn't know better, you'd think you'd strayed into a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. Yeah. Now, can you imagine what it is like to be God? And there's an infinity of them like that going on. And they won't stop saying it. So what is he going to do with them? Each one is singing his own bit, right? In his own way. And he's totally absorbed, because you know in good mystical practice you have to forget everything except God. And remember God in your own unique way. So you sing, that is, you contract, expand your vocal cords, and you make this sound. Uniquely. And you can't make it any other way than uniquely. But you're so locked in yourself, you don't know anybody else exists. Now, logically, you are depriving God of the fun that will arise if you do know somebody else exists. Now, here's a very good little exercise to prove it. We'll have on this side certain kind of angels, on this side other angels, and start singing, O Lord, we praise thee, and the other side listen, and then try to sing something different, but using the same words, O Lord, we praise thee. Are you ready? This side is going to start, O Lord, we praise thee, and this side is going to listen, and then after the first, O Lord, we praise thee, this side will continue, O Lord, we praise thee, repeating, O Lord, we praise thee, O Lord, we praise thee, like in a round, and this side will join in after the first sequence of, O Lord, we praise thee. Got the idea? This side begins and keeps going, O Lord, we praise thee, O Lord, we praise thee, O Lord, we praise thee, O Lord, we praise thee. The tape would sell thousands. It would, yeah. And this side is going to join, and this is an eternal round. Right? And you have to deliberately try to sing differently from this side, whilst at the same time listening to them. Something very peculiar is going to happen that delights God more than the first performance. Right? Ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
Oh.
Wasn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Really? Not joking. Apart from this remarkable individual performance here, who broke the rule by introducing a change of tempo. Yeah? So we'll do it again now. And everybody can change tempo. Not only Gerhard. So if he really wants to stand out, he'll have to have the same tempo. And this time we'll divide into four. Up to that lamp, you see, we've got one section, two, three, four. Right? Up to this lamp here. This block. That block. Then that, and then that. That would be four. But I want this front part will start, O Lord, we praise thee. Then this will follow. Then that will be third, and that will be fourth. And you are to be as different in tempo as in tone, deliberately, to foil Gerhard. It's all part of what is called Leela, divine sport, not intentionally. And you'll hear peculiar things. And the joy will increase. Yes. Okay. 3, 2, 1, 0. You know what it sounded like to me? A Jewish coffee morning. We've only a few people in here, haven't we? And just imagine an infinity of people. Huh? Isn't that lovely? Only one thing wrong. Each person is thinking only about himself. Now, how can we get an extra value? That is, make everybody think about other people. But how can we do it? There's only one way open to us. We must precipitate them into encapsulation and give them a separate physical body. And then drive the bodies to collision. Right? And then it'll be even more interesting and exciting, won't it? And that is the cause of the birth of cosmos and the creation of terrestrial bodies for beings. How are we going to do this time? Right? We'll start with this front row. That's just to give us starters. And we'll let a wave go along. You start, the next row, the next, and the next, and the next. When you get to the back, you start over there at the back and come down here and go round like this. But this time, when you're singing, we've got to introduce another factor called contingent relationship. You are permitted to push the person next to you on either side during the singing whenever you feel like it. Yes. Now remember, I'm sorry, you mustn't push them so hard that you got them out of existence, because we need their voices in the choir celestial. Right? Are we ready? 3, 2, 1, go. Keep going. one of the side effects of this is a saving on the heating bill. Would you believe that? All the best lovers I've known in winter have not put the fire on. They've made one. Remember that, don't you? In these inflationary times. What did we actually find with the addition of contingent relations? You've actually called in energy from infinity that you didn't know you had. And you know you can get sent if you do this exercise. you don't need drugs and mystical mushrooms. If you do this, the energy comes in from the infinite because the infinite is enjoying it. And remember the rule, where you are interested, the infinite is interested. Where man individually is interested, God is interested.